Sister Carlotta tried to be sensitive to the pain these children were suffering, so soon after one of their own was strangled and thrown in the river. But Poke's death was all the more reason to push forward on the testing. A shield had not been found yet. With this Ulysses boy having already struck once, it was unlikely that a shield would come out of hiding for some time. So Sister Carlotta had no choice but to proceed with Bean. At first the boy was distracted and did poorly. Sister Carlotta could not understand how he could fail even the elementary parts of the test when he was so bright he had taught himself to read on the street. It had to be the death of Poke. So she interrupted the test and talked to him about death, about how Poke was caught up in spirit into the presence of God and the saints, who would care for her and make her happier than she had ever been in life. He did not seem interested. If anything, he did worse as they began the next phase of the test. Well, if compassion didn't work, sternness might. "Don't you understand what this test is for, Bean?" she asked. "No," he said. The tone of his voice added the unmistakable idea, "And I don't care." "All you know about is the life on the street. But the streets of Rotterdam are only a part of a great city, and Rotterdam is only one city in a world of thousands of such cities. The whole human race, Bean, that's what this test is about. Because the Formics, the buggers," said Bean. Like most street urchins, he sneered at euphemism. "They will be back, scouring the earth, killing every living soul. This test is to see if you are one of the children who will be taken to battle school and trained to be a commander of the forces that will try to stop them. This test is about saving the world, Bean." For the first time since the test began, Bean turned his full attention to her. "Where is battle school?" "In an orbiting platform in space," she said. "If you do well enough on this test, you get to be a spaceman." There was no childlike eagerness in his face, only hard calculation. "I've been doing real bad so far, haven't I?" he said. "The test results so far show you're too stupid to walk and breathe at the same time. Can I start over?" "I have another version of the tests, yes," said Sister Carlotta. "Do it." As she brought out the alternate set, she smiled at him, tried to relax him again. "So, you want to be a spaceman, is that it? Or is it the idea of being part of the international fleet?" He ignored her. This time through the test, he finished everything, even though the tests were designed not to be finished in the allotted time. His scores were not perfect, but they were close, so close that nobody would believe the results. So she gave him yet another battery of tests, this one designed for older children, the standard tests, in fact, that six-year-olds took when being considered for battle school at the normal age. He did not do as well on these. There were too many experiences he had not had yet to be able to understand the content of some of the questions. But he still did remarkably well, better than any student she had ever tested. And to think she had thought it was Ashiel who had the real potential. This little one, this infant, really, he was astonishing. No one would believe she had found him on the streets, living at the starvation level. A suspicion crept into her mind, and when the second test ended and she recorded the scores and set them aside, she leaned back in her chair and smiled at bleary-eyed little Bean and asked him, "Whose idea was it, this family thing that the street children have come up with?" "Ashiel's idea," said Bean. Sister Carlotta waited. His idea to call it a family, anyway, said Bean. She still waited. Pride would bring more to the surface if she gave him time. But having a bully protect the little ones, that was my plan, said Bean. I told her to poke, and she thought about it and decided to try it, and she only made one mistake.
What mistake was that?
She chose the wrong bully to protect us.
You mean because he couldn't protect her from Ulysses?
Bean laughed bitterly as tears slid down his cheeks. Ulysses is off somewhere, bragging about what he's going to do.
Sister Carlotta knew, but did not want to know. Do you know who killed her then?
I told her to kill him. I told her he was the wrong one. I saw it in his face, lying there on the ground, that he would never forgive her. But he's cold. He waited so long. But he never took bread from her. That should have told her. She shouldn't have gone off alone with him.
He began crying in earnest now.
I think she was protecting me, because I told her to kill him that first day. I think she was trying to get him not to kill me.
Sister Carlotta tried to keep emotion out of her voice. Do you believe you might be in danger from Ashiel?
I am now that I told you, he said.
And then, after a moment's thought,
I was anyway. He doesn't forgive. He pays back. Always.
You realize that this isn't the way Ashiel seems to me, or to Hazy, Helga, that is. To us, he seems civilized. Bean looked at her like she was crazy.
Isn't that what it means to be civilized? That you can wait to get what you want?
You want to get out of Rotterdam and go to battle school so you can get away from Ashiel. Bean nodded. What about the other children? Do you think they're in danger from him?
No, said Bean. He's their papa.
But not yours. Even though he took bread from you.
He hugged her and kissed her, said Bean. I saw them on the dock, and she let him kiss her. And then she said something about how he promised. And so I left. But then I realized, and I ran back. And it couldn't have been long, just running for maybe 6 blocks. And she was dead with her eye stabbed out, floating in the water, bumping up against the dock. He can kiss you and kill you, if he hates you enough.
Sister Carlotta drummed her fingers on the desk. What a quandary.
What's a quandary?
I was going to test Ashiel, too. I think he could get into battle school. Bean's whole body tightened.
Then don't send me. Him or me.
Do you really think? Her voice trailed off. You think he'd try to kill you there?
Try?
His voice was scornful. Ashiel doesn't just try. Sister Carlotta knew that the trait Bean was speaking of, that ruthless determination, was one of the things that they looked for in battle school. It might make Ashiel more attractive to them than Bean. And they could channel such murderous violence up there. Put it to good use. But civilizing the bullies of the street had not been Ashiel's idea. It had been Bean who thought of it. Incredible, for a child so young to conceive of it and bring it about. This child was the prize, not the one who lived for cold vengeance. But one thing was certain. It would be wrong of her to take them both. Though she could certainly take the other one and get him into a school here on Earth, get him off the street, Surely Ashiel would become truly civilized then, where the desperation of the street no longer drove children to do such hideous things to each other. Then she realized what nonsense she had been thinking. It wasn't the desperation of the street that drove Ashiel to murder Polk. It was pride. It was Cain, who thought that being shamed was reason enough to take his brother's life. It was Judas, who did not shrink to kiss before killing. What was she thinking? To treat evil as if it were a mere mechanical product of deprivation. All the children of the street suffered fear and hunger, helplessness and desperation, but they didn't all become cold-blooded, calculating murderers. If, that is, Bean was right. But she had no doubt that Bean was telling her the truth. If Bean was lying, she would give up on herself as a judge of children's character. Now that she thought about it, Ashiel was slick, a flatterer. Everything he said was calculated to impress. But Bean said little, and spoke plainly when he did speak. And he was young, and his fear and grief here in this room were real. Of course, he also had urged that a child be killed, but only because he posed a danger to others. It wasn't pride. How can I judge? Isn't Christ supposed to be the judge of quick and dead? Why is this in my hands when I am not fit to do it? Would you like to stay here, Bean, while I transmit your test results to the people who make the decisions about battle school? You'll be safe here. He looked down at his hands, nodded, then laid his head on his arms and sobbed.
Ashiel came back to the nest that morning. I couldn't stay away, he said. Too much could go wrong. He took them to breakfast just like always. But Polk and Bean weren't there. Then Sergeant did his rounds, listening here and there, talking to other kids, talking to an adult here and there, finding out what was happening, anything that might be useful. It was at the dock that he heard some of the longshoremen talking about the body found in the river that morning, a little girl. Sergeant found out where her body was being held till the authorities arrived. He didn't shy away. He walked right up to the body under a tarpaulin, and without asking permission from any of the others standing there, he pulled it back and looked at her.
"What are you doing, boy?"
"Her name is Polk," he said.
"You know her? Do you know who might have killed her?"
"A boy named Ulysses. That's who killed her," said Sergeant. Then he dropped the tarp, and his rounds were over. Ashiel had to know that his fears had been justified, that Ulysses was taking out anybody he could from the family. "We've got no choice but to kill him," said Sergeant.
"There's been enough bloodshed," said Ashiel, "but I'm afraid you're right." Some of the younger children were crying. One of them explained,
"Polk fed me when I was going to die."
"Shut up," said Sergeant. "We're eating better now than we ever did when Polk was boss."
Ashiel put a hand on Sergeant's arm to still him. "Polk did the best a crew boss could do, and she's the one who got me into the family. So in a way, anything I get for you, she got for you." Everyone nodded solemnly at that. A kid asked,
"You think Ulysses got Bean, too?"
"Big loss if he did," said Sergeant.
"Any loss to my family is a big loss," said Ashiel. "But there'll be no more. Ulysses will either leave the city now or he's dead. Put the word out, Sergeant. Let it be known on the street that the challenge stands. Ulysses doesn't eat in any kitchen in town until he faces me. That's what he decided for himself when he chose to put a knife in Polk's eye."
Sergeant saluted him and took off at a run, the picture of business-like obedience.
except that as he ran, he too was crying. For he had not told anyone how Poke died, how her eye was a bloody wound. Maybe Ashiel knew some other way. Maybe he had already heard, but didn't mention it till Sergeant came back with the news. Maybe. Sergeant knew the truth. Ulysses didn't raise his hand against anybody. Ashiel did it, just as Bean warned in the beginning. Ashiel would never forgive Poke for beating him. He killed her now because Ulysses would get blamed for it. And then sat there talking about how good she was and how they should all be grateful to her, and everything Ashiel got for them, it was really Poke who got it. So, Bean was right all along, about everything. Ashiel might be a good papa to the family, but he was also a killer, and he never forgives. Poke knew that, though. Bean warned her, and she knew it, but she chose Ashiel for their papa anyway. Chose him and then died for it. She was like Jesus that Helga preached about in her kitchen while they ate. She died for her people. And Ashiel, he was like God. He made people pay for their sins no matter what they did. The important thing is, stay on the good side of God. That's what Helga teaches, isn't it? Stay right with God. I'll stay right with Ashiel. I'll honor my papa, that's for sure, so I can stay alive until I'm old enough to go out on my own. As for Bean, well, he was smart, but not smart enough to stay alive, and if you're not smart enough to stay alive, then you're better off dead. By the time Sergeant got to his first corner to spread the word about Ashiel's ban on Ulysses from any kitchen in town, he was through crying. Grief was done. This was about survival now. Even though Sergeant knew Ulysses hadn't killed anybody, he meant to, and it was still important for the family's safety that he die. Poke's death provided a good excuse to demand that the rest of the papas stand back and let Ashiel deal with him. When it was all over, Ashiel would be the leader among all the papas of Rotterdam, and Sergeant would stand beside him, knowing the secret of his vengeance and telling no one. Because that's how Sergeant, that's how the family, that's how all the urchins of Rotterdam would survive.
Chapter 4. Memories.
I was mistaken about the first one. He tests well, but his character is not well suited to battle school.
I don't see that on the tests you've shown me.
He's very sharp. He gives the right answers, but they aren't true.
And what test did you use to determine this?
He has committed murder.
Well, that is a drawback. And the other one, what am I supposed to do with so young a child? A fish this small I would generally throw back into the stream.
Teach him. Feed him. He'll grow.
He doesn't even have a name.
Yes, he does.
Bean? That isn't a name, it's a joke.
It won't be when he's done with it.
Keep him until he's 5. Make of him what you can and show me your results then.
I have other children to find.
No, Sister Carlotta, you don't. In all your years of searching, this one is the best you've found, and there isn't time to find another. Bring this one up to snuff, and all your work will be worth it as far as the IF is concerned.
You frighten me when you say there isn't time.
I don't see why. Christians have been expecting the imminent end of the world for millennia.
But it keeps not ending.
So far, so good.
At first, all Bean cared about was the food. There was enough of it. He ate everything they put before him. He ate until he was full. That most miraculous of words, which till now had had no meaning for him. He ate until he was stuffed. He ate until he was sick. He ate so often that he had bowel movements every day, sometimes twice a day. He laughed about it to Sister Carlotta. All I do is eat and poop, he said. Like any beast of the forest, said the nun, it's time for you to begin to earn that food. She was already teaching him, of course, daily lessons in reading and arithmetic, bringing him up to level, though what level she had in mind she never specified. She also gave him time to draw, and there were sessions where she had him sit there and try to remember every detail about his earliest memories. The clean place in particular fascinated her. But there were limits to memory. He was very small then, and had very little language. Everything was a mystery. He did remember climbing over the railing around his bed and falling to the floor. He didn't walk well at the time. Crawling was easier, but he liked walking because that's what the big people did. He clung to objects and leaned on walls and made good progress on 2 feet, only crawling when he had to cross an open space. "You must have been 8 or 9 months old," Sister Carlotta. "Most people don't remember that far back." "I remember that everybody was upset. That's why I climbed out of bed. All the children were in trouble."
"All the children?"
"The little ones like me. And the bigger ones. Some of the grown-ups came in and looked at us and cried."
"Why?"
"Bad things, that's all. I knew it was a bad thing coming, and I knew it would happen to all of us who were in the beds. So I climbed out. I wasn't the first. I don't know what happened to the others. I heard the grown-ups yelling and getting all upset when they found the empty beds. I hid from them. They didn't find me. Maybe they found the others, maybe they didn't. All I know is when I came out, all the beds were empty and the room was very dark except a lighted sign that said, 'Exit.'"
"You could read then?"
She sounded skeptical.
"When I could read, I remembered that those were the letters on the sign," said Bean. "They were the only letters I saw back then. Of course I remembered them."
"So you were alone, and the beds were empty, and the room was dark." "They came back. I heard them talking. I didn't understand most of the words. I hid again. And this time when I came out, even the beds were gone. Instead, there were desks and cabinets. An office. And no, I didn't know what an office was then either, but now I do know what an office is, and I remember that's what the rooms had all become. Offices. People came in during the day and worked there. Only a few at first, but my hiding place turned out not to be so good when people were working there. And I was hungry."
"Where did you hide?"
"Come on, you know. Don't you?"
"If I knew, I wouldn't ask."
"You saw the way I acted when you showed me the toilet."
"You hid inside the toilet?"
"The tank on the back. It was hard to get the lid up, and it wasn't comfortable in there. I didn't know what it was for, but people started using it and the water rose and fell and the pieces moved and it scared me. And like I said, I was hungry. Plenty to drink, except that I peed in it myself. My diaper was so waterlogged it fell off my butt. I was naked."
"Bean, do you understand what you're telling me? That you were doing all this before you were a year old?"
"You're the one who said how old I was," said Bean. "I didn't know about ages then. You told me to remember. The more I tell you, the more it comes back to me. But if you don't believe me, I do believe you. But who were the other children? What was the place where you lived, that clean place? Who were those grown-ups? Why did they take away the other children? Something illegal was going on, that's certain."
"Whatever," said Bean. "I was just glad to get out of the toilet."
"But you were naked, you said. And you left the place?"
"No. I got found. I came out of the toilet and a grown-up found me."
"What happened?"
"He took me home. That's how I got clothing. I called them clothings then."
"You were talking?"
"Some."
"And this grown-up took you home and bought you clothing?"
"I think he was a janitor.
I know more about jobs now, and I think that's what he was. It was night when he worked, and he didn't wear a uniform like a guard."
"What happened?"
That's when I first found out about legal and illegal. It wasn't legal for him to have a child. I heard him yelling at this woman about me, and most of it I didn't understand, but at the end I knew he had lost and she had won, and he started talking to me about how I had to go away, and so I went.
He just turned you loose in the streets?
No. I left. I think now he was going to have to give me to somebody else, and it sounded scary, so I left before he could do it. But I wasn't naked or hungry anymore. He was nice. After I left, I bet he didn't have any more trouble.
And that's when you started living on the streets?
Sort of. A couple of places I found, they fed me. But every time other kids, big ones, would see that I was getting fed, and they'd come shouting and begging, and the people would stop feeding me, or the bigger kids would shove me out of the way, or take the food right out of my hands. I was scared. One time a big kid got so mad at me for eating that he put a stick down my throat and made me throw up what I just ate, right on the street. He even tried to eat it, but he couldn't. It made him try to throw up, too. That was the scariest time. I hid it all the time after that. Hid. All the time.
And starved.
And watched, said Bean. I ate some. Now and then. I didn't die.
No, you didn't.
I saw plenty who did. Lots of dead children. Big ones and little ones. I kept wondering how many of them were from the clean place.
Did you recognize any of them?
No. Nobody looked like they ever lived in the clean place. Everybody looked hungry.
Bean, thank you for telling me all this.
You asked. Do you realize that there is no way you could have survived for 3 years as an infant? I guess that means I'm dead.
I'm saying that God must have been watching over you.
Yeah. Well, sure.
So why didn't he watch over all those dead kids?
He took them to his heart and loved them.
So then he didn't love me?
No, he loved you too. Because if he was watching so careful, he could have given me something to eat now and then.
He brought me to you.
He has some great purpose in mind for you, Bean. You may not know what it is, but God didn't keep you alive so miraculously for no reason.
Bean was tired of talking about this. She looked so happy when she talked about God, but he hadn't figured it out yet, what God even was. It was like she wanted to give God credit for every good thing, but when it was bad, then she either didn't mention God or had some reason why it was a good thing after all. As far as Bean could see, though, the dead kids would rather have been alive, just with more food. If God loved them so much and he could do whatever he wanted, then why wasn't there more food for these kids? And if God just wanted them dead, why didn't he let them die sooner or not even be born at all, so they didn't have to go to so much trouble and get all excited about trying to be alive when he was just going to take them to his heart? None of it made any sense to Bean, and the more Sister Carlotta explained it, the less he understood it. Because if there was somebody in charge, then he ought to be fair. And if he wasn't fair, then why should Sister Carlotta be so happy that he was in charge? But when he tried to say things like that to her, she got really upset and talked even more about God and used words he didn't know, and it was better just to let her say what she wanted and not argue. It was the reading that fascinated him. And the numbers. He loved that. Having paper and pencil so he could actually write things? That was really good. And maps. She didn't teach him maps at first, but there were some on the walls, and the shapes of them fascinated him. He would go up to them and read the little words written on them, and one day he saw the name of the river and realized that the blue was rivers, and even bigger blue areas were places with even more water than the river. And then he realized that some of the other words were the same names that had been written on the street signs, and so he figured out that somehow this thing was a picture of Rotterdam. And then it all made sense. Rotterdam the way it would look to a bird, if the buildings were all invisible and the streets were all empty. He found where the nest was, and where Polk had died, and all kinds of other places. When Sister Carlotta found out that he understood the map, she got very excited. She showed him maps where Rotterdam was just a little patch of lines, and one where it was just a dot, and one where it was too small even to be seen, but she knew where it would be. Bean had never realized the world was so big, or that there were so many people. But Sister Carlotta kept coming back to the Rotterdam map, trying to get him to remember where things from his earliest memories were. Nothing looked the same, though, on the map, so it wasn't easy, and it took a long time for him to figure out where some of the places were where people had fed him. He showed these to Sister Carlotta, and she made a mark right on the map showing each place. And after a while, he realized. All those places were grouped in one area, but kind of strung out, as if they marked a path from where he found Polk, leading back through time to the clean place. Only that was too hard. He had been too scared coming out of the clean place with the janitor. He didn't know where it was. And the truth was, as Sister Carlotta herself said, the janitor might have lived anywhere compared to the clean place. So all she was going to find by following Bean's path backward was maybe the janitor's flat, or at least where he lived 3 years ago. And even then, what would the janitor know? He would know where the clean place was. That's what he'd know. And now Bean understood. It was very important to Sister Carlotta to find out where Bean came from, to find out who he really was. Only, he already knew who he really was. He tried to say this to her. I'm right here. This is who I really am. I'm not pretending. I know that, she said, laughing, and she hugged him, which was all right. It felt good. Back when she first started doing it, he didn't know what to do with his hands. She had to show him how to hug her back. He had seen some little kids, the ones with mamas or papas, doing that, but he always thought they were holding on tight so they wouldn't drop off onto the street and get lost. He didn't know that you did it just because it felt good. Sister Carlotta's body had hard places and squishy places, and it was very strange to hug her. He thought of Polk and Ashiel hugging and kissing, but he didn't want to kiss Sister Carlotta, and after he got used to what hugging was, he didn't really want to do that either. He let her hug him, but he didn't ever think of hugging her himself. It just didn't come into his mind. He knew that sometimes she hugged him instead of explaining things to him, and he didn't like that. She didn't want to tell him why it mattered that she find the clean place, so she hugged him and said, "Oh, you dear thing," or, "Oh, you poor boy." But that only meant that it was even more important than she was saying, and she thought he was too stupid or ignorant to understand if she tried to explain. He kept trying to remember more and more if he could, only now he didn't tell her everything because she didn't tell him everything, and fair was fair. He would find the clean room himself, without her, and then tell her if he decided it would be good for him to have her know. Because what if she found the wrong answer? Would she put him back on the street? Would she keep him from going to school in the sky? Because that's what she promised at first, only after the tests she said he did very well, only he would not go in the sky until he was 5, and maybe not even then because it was not entirely her decision, and that's when he knew that she didn't have the power to keep her own promises. So if she found out the wrong thing about him, she might not be able to keep any of her promises. Not even the one about keeping him safe from Ashiel. That's why he had to find out on his own. He studied the map. He pictured things in his mind. He talked to himself as he was falling asleep, talked and thought and remembered, trying to get the janitor's face back into his mind, and the room he lived in, and the stairs outside where the mean lady stood to scream at him. And one day, when he thought he had remembered enough, Bean went to the toilet. He liked the toilets. He liked to make them flush, even though it scared him to see things disappear like that. And instead of coming back to Sister Carlotta's teaching place, he went the other way down the corridor and went right out the door onto the street, and no one tried to stop him. That's when he realized his mistake, though. He had been so busy trying to remember the janitor's place that it never occurred to him that he had no idea where this place was on the map. And it wasn't in a part of town that he knew. In fact, it hardly seemed like the same world. Instead of the street being full of people walking and pushing carts and riding bikes or skating to get from one place to another, the streets were almost empty, and there were cars parked everywhere. Not a single store, either. All houses and offices, or houses made into offices with little signs out front. The only building that was different was the very one he had just come out of. It was blocky and square and bigger than the others, but it had no sign out in front of it at all. He knew where he was going, but he didn't know how to get there from here. And Sister Carlotta would start looking for him soon. His first thought was to hide, but then he remembered that she knew all about his story of hiding in the clean place, so she would also think of hiding, and she would look for him in a hiding place close to the big building. So he ran. It surprised him how strong he was now. It felt like he could run as fast as a bird flying, and he didn't get tired. He could run forever. All the way to the corner and around it, onto another street. Then down another street, and another, until he would have been lost, except he started out lost, and when you start out completely lost, it's hard to get loster. As he walked and trotted and jogged and ran up and down streets and alleys, he realized that all he had to do was find a canal or a stream, and it would lead him to the river or to a place that he recognized. So the first bridge that went over water, he saw which way the water went and chose streets that would keep him close. It wasn't as if he knew where he was yet, but at least he was following a plan. It worked. He came to the river and walked along it until he recognized, off in the distance and partly around a bend in the river, the place where Poke was killed. The bend in the river. He knew it from the map. He knew where all of Sister Carlotta's marks had been. He knew that he had to go through the place where he used to live on the streets in order to get past them and closer to the area where the janitor might have lived. And that wouldn't be easy, because he would be known there, and Sister Carlotta might even have the cops looking for him, and they would look there, because that's where all the street urchins were, and they would expect him to become a street urchin again. What they were forgetting was that Bean wasn't hungry anymore. And since he wasn't hungry, he wasn't in a hurry. He walked the long way around, far from the river, far from the busy part of town where the urchins were. Whenever the streets started looking crowded, he would widen his circle and stay away from the busy places. He took the rest of that day and most of the next, making such a wide circle that for a while he was not in Rotterdam anymore at all, and he saw some of the countryside, just like the pictures. Farmland and the roads built up higher than the land around them. Sister Carlotta had explained to him once that most of the farmland was lower than the level of the sea, and great dikes were the only thing keeping the sea from rushing back onto the land and covering it. But Bean knew that he would never get close to any of the big dikes. Not by walking, anyway. He drifted back into town now, and late in the afternoon of the second day he recognized the name of a street and soon found a cross street whose name he knew, and then it was easy to get to the earliest place he could remember, the back door of a restaurant where he had been fed when he was still a baby and didn't talk right, and grown-ups rushed to feed him and help him instead of kicking him out of the way. He stood there in the dusk. Nothing had changed. He could almost picture the woman with the little bowl of food holding it out to him and waving a spoon in her hand and saying something in a language he didn't understand. Now he could read the sign above the restaurant and realize that it was Armenian, and that's probably what the woman had been speaking. Which way had he walked to come here? He had smelled the food when he was walking along... here? He walked a little way up, a little way down the street, turning and turning to reorient himself. "What are you doing here, Fatso?" It was two kids, maybe 8 years old.
belligerent, but not bullies. Probably part of a crew. No, part of a family, now that Ashiel had changed everything. If the changes had spread to this part of town.
I'm supposed to meet my papa here, said Bean.
And who's your papa? Bean wasn't sure whether they took the word papa to mean his father or the papa of his family. He took the chance, though, of saying, Ashiel. They scoffed at the idea. He's way down by the river. Why would he meet a fatso like you clear up here? But their derision was not important. What mattered is that Ashiel's reputation had spread this far through the city. I don't have to explain his business to you, said Bean. And all the kids in Ashiel's family are fat like me. That's how well we eat. Are they all short like you? I used to be taller, but I asked too many questions, said Bean, pushing past them and walking on toward the area where the janitor's flat seemed likeliest to be. They didn't follow him. Such was the magic of Ashiel's name. Or perhaps it was just Bean's utter confidence, paying them no notice as if he had nothing to fear from them. Nothing looked familiar. He kept turning around and checking to see if he recognized things when looking in the direction he might have been going after leaving the janitor's flat. It didn't help. He wandered until it was dark and kept wandering even then. Until quite by chance, he found himself standing at the foot of a street lamp, trying to read a sign, when a set of initials carved on the pole caught his attention. P-A-D-V-M, it said. He had no idea what it meant. He had never thought of it during all his attempts to remember. But he knew that he had seen it before. And not just once. He had seen it several times. The janitor's flat was very close. He turned slowly, scanning the area. And there it was. A small apartment building with both an inside and an outside stairway. The janitor lived on the top floor. Ground floor, first floor, second floor, third. Bean went to the mailboxes and tried to read the names, but they were set too high on the wall and the names were all faded, or the tag was missing entirely. Not that he ever knew the janitor's name, truth to tell. There was no reason to think he would have recognized it even if he had been able to read it on the mailbox. The outside stairway did not go all the way up to the top floor. It must have been built for a doctor's office on the first floor. And because it was dark, the door at the top of the stairs was locked. There was nothing to do but wait. Either he would wait all night and get into the building through one entrance or another in the morning, or someone would come back in the night and Bean would slip through a door behind him. He fell asleep and woke up, slept and woke again. He worried that a policeman would see him and shove him away, so when he woke the second time, he abandoned all pretense of being on watch and crept under the stairs and curled up there for the night. He was awakened by drunken laughter. It was still dark and beginning to rain just a little. Not enough to start dripping off the stairs, though, so Bean was dry. He stuck his head out to see who was laughing. It was a man and a woman, both merry with alcohol, the man furtively pawing and poking and pinching, the woman fending him off with half-hearted slaps. "Can you wait?" she said. "No," he said. "You're just going to fall asleep without doing anything," she said. "Not this time," he said. Then he threw up. She looked disgusted and walked on without him. He staggered after her. "I feel better now," he said. "It'll be better." "The price just went up," she said coldly. "And you brush your teeth first."
"Of course I brush my teeth."
They were right at the front of the building now. Bean was waiting to slip in after them. Then he realized that he didn't have to wait. The man was the janitor from all those years before. Bean stepped out of the shadows.
"Thanks for bringing him home," he said to the woman.
They both looked at him in surprise.
"Who are you?"
asked the janitor. Bean looked at the woman and rolled his eyes.
"He's not that drunk, I hope," said Bean.
To the janitor, he said, "Mama will not be happy to see you come home like this again."
"Mama?" said the janitor. "Who the hell are you talking about?"
The woman gave the janitor a shove. He was so off balance that he lurched against the wall, then slid down it to land on his buttocks on the sidewalk.
"I should have known," she said. "You bring me home to your wife?"
"I'm not married," said the janitor. "This kid isn't mine."
"I'm sure you're telling the truth on both points," said the woman. "But you better let him help you up the stairs anyway. Mama's waiting."
She started to walk away.
"What about my 40 guilders? He asked plaintively, knowing the answer even as he asked.
She made an obscene gesture and walked on into the night.
"You little bastard," said the janitor. "I had to talk to you alone," said Bean.
"Who the hell are you? Who's your mama?"
"That's what I'm here to find out," said Bean. "I'm the baby you found and brought home 3 years ago.
The man looked at him in stupefaction. Suddenly a light went on, then another. Bean and the janitor were bathed in overlapping flashlight beams. 4 policemen converged on them.
"Don't bother running, kid," said a cop.
"Nor you, Mr. Funtime." Bean recognized Sister Carlotta's voice.
"They aren't criminals," she said. "I just need to talk to them.
Up in his apartment."
"You followed me?"
Bean asked her.
"I knew you were searching for him," she said. "I didn't want to interfere until you found him.
Just in case you think you were really smart, young man, we intercepted 4 street thugs and 2 known sex offenders who were after you."
Bean rolled his eyes. "You think I've forgotten how to deal with them?"
Sister Carlotta shrugged. "I didn't want this to be the first time you ever made a mistake in your life." She did have a sarcastic streak.
"So, as I told you, there was nothing to learn from this Pablo de Noches. He's an immigrant who lives to pay for prostitutes. Just another of the worthless people who have gravitated here ever since the Netherlands became international territory." Sister Carlotta had sat patiently, waiting for the inspector to wind down his "I told you so" speech. But when he spoke of a man's worthlessness, she could not let the remark go unchallenged. "He took in that baby," she said, "and fed the child and cared for him." The inspector waved off the objection. "We needed one more street urchin, because that's all that people like this ever produce." "You didn't learn nothing from him," Sister Carlotta said. "You learned the location where the boy was found. And the people renting the building during that time are untraceable. A company name that never existed. Nothing to go on. No way to track them down."
"But that nothing is something," said Sister Carlotta. "I tell you that these people had many children in this place, which they closed down in a hurry, with all the children but one taken away. You tell me that the company was a false name and can't be traced. So now, in your experience, doesn't that tell you a great deal about what was going on in that building?" The inspector shrugged. "Of course. It was obviously an organ farm." Tears came to Sister Carlotta's eyes.
"And that is the only possibility?" "A lot of defective babies are born to rich families," said the inspector. "There is an illegal market in infant and toddler organs. We close down the organ farms whenever we find out where they are. Perhaps we were getting close to this organ farm, and they got wind of it and closed up shop. But there is no paper in the department on any organ farm that we actually found at that time. So perhaps they closed down for another reason. Still, nothing."
Patiently, Sister Carlotta ignored his inability to realize how valuable this information was. "Where do the babies come from?" The inspector looked at her blankly, as if he thought she was asking him to explain the facts of life. "The organ farm," she said. "Where do they get the babies?" The inspector shrugged.
"Well, late-term abortions, usually. Some arrangement with the clinics, a kickback, that sort of thing."
And that's the only source? Well, I don't know. Kidnappings? I don't think that could be much of a factor. There aren't that many babies leaking through the security systems in the hospitals. People selling babies? It's been heard of, yes. Poor refugees arrive with 8 children, and then a few years later they have only 6, and they cry about the ones who died, but who can prove anything? But nothing you can trace.
The reason I'm asking, said Sister Carlotta, is that this child is unusual. Extremely unusual.
3 arms? Asked the inspector.
Brilliant. Precocious. He escaped from this place before he was 1 year old, before he could walk.
The inspector thought about that for a few moments. He crawled away?
He hid in a toilet tank.
He got the lid up before he was 1 year old?
He said it was hard to lift.
No, it was probably cheap plastic, not porcelain. You know how these institutional plumbing fixtures are.
You can see, though, why I want to know about the child's parentage. Some miraculous combination of parents.
The inspector shrugged. Some children are born smart.
But there is a hereditary component in this, Inspector. A child like this must have remarkable parents. Parents likely to be prominent because of the brilliance of their own minds.
Maybe, maybe not, said the inspector. I mean, some of these refugees, they might be brilliant, but they're caught up in desperate times. To save the other children, maybe they sell a baby. That's even a smart thing to do. It doesn't rule out refugees as the parents of this brilliant boy you have.
I suppose that's possible, said Sister Carlotta.
It's the most information you'll ever have. Because this Pablo de Noches, he knows nothing. He barely could tell me the name of the town he came from in Spain.
He was drunk when he was questioned, said Sister Carlotta.
We'll question him again when he's sober, said the inspector. We'll let you know if we learn anything more. In the meantime, though, you'll have to make do with what I've already told you, because there isn't anything more.
I know all I need to know for now, said Sister Carlotta. Enough to know that this child truly is a miracle, raised up by God for some great purpose.
I'm not Catholic, said the inspector.
God loves you all the same, said Sister Carlotta cheerfully.
Part 2. Launchy. Chapter 5. Ready or Not.
Why are you giving me a 5-year-old street urchin to tend?
You've seen the scores.
Am I supposed to take these seriously?
Since the whole battle school program is based on the reliability of our juvenile testing program, yes, I think you should take his scores seriously. I did a little research. No child has ever done better, not even your star pupil.
It's not the validity of the tests that I doubt. It's the tester.
Sister Carlotta is a nun. You'll never find a more honest person.
Honest people have been known to deceive themselves. To want so desperately after all these years of searching to find one, just one child whose value will be worth all that work.
And she's found him.
Look at the way she found him. Her first report touts this Achilles child, and this... this bean, this legume. He's just an afterthought. When Achilles is gone, not another mention of him. Did he die? Wasn't she trying to get a leg operation for him? And it's Arico Vare who is now her candidate.
Bean is the name he calls himself. Rather, as your Andrew Wiggin calls himself, Ender.
He's not my Andrew Wiggin.
And Bean is not Sister Carlotta's child, either. If she were inclined to fudge the scores or administer tests unfairly, she would have pushed other students into the program long before now, and would already know how unreliable she was. She has never done that. She washes out her most hopeful children herself, then finds some place for them on Earth or in a non-command program. I think you're merely annoyed because you've already decided to focus all your attention and energy on the Wiggin boy, and you don't want any distraction.
And when did I lie down on your couch?
If my analysis is wrong, do forgive me.
Of course, I'll give this little one a chance. Even if I don't, for one second, believe these scores.
Not just a chance. Advance him. Test him. Challenge him. Don't let him languish.
You underestimate our program. We advance and test and challenge all our students.
But some are more equal than others.
Some take better advantage of the program than others.
I'll look forward to telling Sister Carlotta about your enthusiasm.
Sister Carlotta shed tears when she told Bean that it was time for him to leave. Bean shed none. I understand that you're afraid, Bean, but don't be, she said. You'll be safe there, and there's so much to learn. The way you drink down knowledge, you'll be very happy there in no time. So you won't really miss me at all. Bean blinked. What sign had he given that made her think he was afraid, or that he would miss her? He felt none of those things. When he first met her, he might have been prepared to feel something for her. She was kind. She fed him. She was keeping him safe, giving him a life. But then he found Pablo the janitor, and there was Sister Carlotta stopping Bean from talking to the man who had saved him long before she did. Nor would she tell him anything that Pablo had said, or anything she had learned about the clean place. From that moment, trust was gone. Bean knew that whatever Sister Carlotta was doing, it wasn't for him. She was using him. He didn't know what for. It might even be something he would have chosen to do himself. But she wasn't telling him the truth. She had secrets from him, the way Ashiel kept secrets. So during the months that she was his teacher, he had grown more and more distant from her. Everything she taught, he learned. And much that she didn't teach as well. He took every test she gave him and did well, but he showed her nothing he had learned that she hadn't taught him. Of course, life with Sister Carlotta was better than life on the street. He had no intention of going back, but he did not trust her. He was on guard all the time. He was as careful as he had ever been back in Ashiel's family. Those brief days at the beginning, when he wept in front of her, when he let go of himself and spoke freely? That had been a mistake that he would not repeat. Life was better, but he wasn't safe. And this wasn't home. Her tears were real enough, he knew. She really did love him and would really miss him when he left. After all, he had been a perfect child, compliant, quick, obedient. To her, that meant he was good. To him, it was only a way of keeping his access to food and learning. He wasn't stupid. Why did she assume he was afraid? Because she was afraid for him. Therefore, there might indeed be something to fear. He would be careful. And why did she assume that he would miss her? Because she would miss him, and she could not imagine that what she was feeling, he might not feel as well. She had created an imaginary version of him, like the games of let's pretend that she tried to play with him a couple of times,
harking back to her own childhood, no doubt, growing up in a house where there was always enough food. Bean didn't have to pretend things in order to exercise his imagination when he was on the street. Instead, he had to imagine his plans for how to get food, for how to insinuate himself into a crew, for how to survive when he knew he seemed useless to everyone. He had to imagine how and when Ashiel would decide to act against him for having advocated that Poke kill him. He had to imagine danger around every corner, a bully ready to seize every scrap of food. Oh, he had plenty of imagination. But he had no interest at all in playing Let's Pretend. That was her game. She played it all the time. Let's pretend that Bean is a good little boy. Let's pretend that Bean is the son that this nun can never have for real. Let's pretend that when Bean leaves, he'll cry. That he's not crying now because he's too afraid of this new school, this journey into space, to let his emotions show. Let's pretend that Bean loves me. And when he understood this, he made a decision. It will do no harm to me if she believes all this. And she wants very much to believe it. So why not give it to her? After all, Poke let me stay with the crew even though she didn't need me, because it would do no harm. It's the kind of thing Poke would do. So Bean slid off his chair, walked around the table to Sister Carlotta, and put his arms as far around her as they would reach. She gathered him up onto her lap and held him tight, her tears flowing into his hair. He hoped her nose wasn't running. But he clung to her as long as she clung to him, letting go only when she let go of him. It was what she wanted from him, the only payment that she had ever asked of him. For all the meals, the lessons, the books, the language, for his future, he owed her no less than to join her in this game of Let's Pretend. Then the moment passed. He slid off her lap. She dabbed at her eyes. Then she rose, took his hand, and led him out to the waiting soldiers, to the waiting car. As he approached the car, the uniformed men loomed over him. It was not the gray uniform of the IT police, those kickers of children, those wielders of sticks. Rather, it was the sky blue of the international fleet that they wore, a cleaner look, and the people who gathered around to watch showed no fear, but rather admiration. This was the uniform of distant power, of safety for humanity, the uniform on which all hope depended. This was the service he was about to join. But he was so small, and as they looked down at him, he was afraid after all, and clung more tightly to Sister Carlotta's hand. Was he going to become one of them? Was he going to be a man in such a uniform, with such admiration directed at him? Then why was he afraid? I'm afraid, Bean thought, because I don't see how I can ever be so tall. One of the soldiers bent down to him to lift him into the car. Bean glared up at him, defying him to dare such a thing. I can do it, he said. The soldier nodded slightly and stood upright again. Bean hooked his leg up onto the running board of the car and hoisted himself in. It was high off the ground, and the seat he held to was slick and offered scant purchase to his hands. But he made it, and positioned himself in the middle of the back seat, the only position where he could see between the front seats and have some idea of where the car would be going. One of the soldiers got into the driver's seat. Bean expected the other to get into the back seat beside Bean, and anticipated an argument about whether Bean could sit in the middle or not. Instead, he got into the front on the other side. Bean was alone in back. He looked out the side window at Sister Carlotta. She was still dabbing at her eyes with a handkerchief. She gave him a little wave. He waved back. She sobbed a little. The car glided forward along the magnetic track in the road. Soon they were outside the city, gliding through the countryside at 150 kilometers an hour. Ahead was the Amsterdam airport, one of only three in Europe that could launch one of the shuttles that could fly into orbit. Bean was through with Rotterdam. For the time being, at least.
He was through with Earth. Since Bean had never flown on an airplane, he did not understand how different the shuttle was, though that seemed to be all that the other boys could talk about at first.
I thought it would be bigger. Doesn't it take off straight up?
That was the old shuttle, stupid.
There aren't any tray tables.
That's 'cause in Null G you can't set anything down anyway, bonehead. To Bean, the sky was the sky, and all he'd ever cared about was whether it was going to rain or snow or blow or burn. Going up into space did not seem any more strange to him than going up to the clouds. What fascinated him were the other children. Boys, most of them, and all older than him. Definitely all larger. Some of them looked at him oddly, and behind him he heard one whisper, "Is he a kid or a doll?" But snide remarks about his size and his age were nothing new to him. In fact, what surprised him was that there was only the one remark, and it was whispered. The kids themselves fascinated him. They were all so fat, so soft. Their bodies were like pillows, their cheeks full, their hair thick, their clothes well fitted. Bean knew, of course, that he had more fat on him now than at any time since he left the clean place, but he didn't see himself. He only saw them, and couldn't help comparing them to the kids on the street. Sergeant could take any of them apart. Ashiel could... Well, no use thinking about Ashiel. Bean tried to imagine them lining up outside a charity kitchen, or scrounging for candy wrappers to lick. What a joke. They had never missed a meal in their lives. Bean wanted to punch them all so hard in the stomach that they would puke up everything they ate that day. Let them feel some pain there in their gut, that gnawing hunger. And then let them feel it again the next day and the next hour, morning and night, waking and sleeping, the constant weakness fluttering just inside your throat, the faintness behind your eyes, the headache, the dizziness, the swelling of your joints, the distension of your belly, the thinning of your muscles until you barely have strength to stand. These children had never looked death in the face and then chosen to live anyway. They were confident. They were unwary. These children are no match for me. And with just as much certainty, I will never catch up to them. They'll always be bigger, stronger, quicker, healthier, happier. They talked to each other boastfully, spoke wistfully of home, mocked the children who had failed to qualify to come with them, pretended to have inside knowledge about how things really were in battle school. Bean said nothing. Just listened, watched them maneuver, some of them determined to assert their place in the hierarchy, others quieter because they knew their place would be lower down. A handful relaxed, unworried, because they had never had to worry about the pecking order, having been always at the top of it. A part of Bean wanted to engage in the contest and win it, clawing his way to the top of the hill. Another part of him disdained the whole group of them. What would it mean, really, to be top dog in this mangy pack? Then he glanced down at his small hands and at the hands of the boy sitting next to him. I really do look like a doll compared to the rest of them. Some of the kids were complaining about how hungry they were. There was a strict rule against eating for 24 hours before the shuttle flight, and most of these kids had never gone so long without eating. For Bean, 24 hours without food was barely noticeable. In his crew, you didn't worry about hunger until the second week. The shuttle took off, just like any airplane, though it had a long, long runway to get it up to speed. It was so heavy. Bean was surprised at the motion of the plane, the way it charged forward yet seemed to hold still, the way it rocked a little and sometimes bumped as if it were rolling over irregularities in an invisible road. When they got up to a high altitude, they rendezvoused with two fuel planes in order to take on the rest of the rocket fuel needed to achieve escape velocity. The plane could never have lifted off the ground with that much fuel on board. During the refueling, a man emerged from the control cabin and stood at the front of the rows of seats. His sky-blue uniform was crisp and perfect, and his smile looked every bit as starched and pressed and unstainable as his clothes. "My dear, darling little children," he said, "some of you apparently can't read yet. Your seat harnesses are to remain in place throughout the entire flight. Why are so many of them unfastened? Are you going somewhere?" Lots of little clicks answered him like scattered applause. "And let me also warn you that no matter how annoying or enticing some other child might be, keep your hands to yourself. You should keep in mind that the children around you scored every bit as high as you did on every test you took, and some of them scored higher." Bean thought, "That's impossible. Somebody here had to have the highest score." A boy across the aisle apparently had the same thought. "Right," he said sarcastically. "I was making a point, but I'm willing to digress," said the man. "Please, share with us the thought that so enthralled you that you could not contain it silently within you." The boy knew he had made a mistake, but decided to tough it out. "Somebody here has the highest score." The man continued looking at him, as if inviting him to continue. Inviting him to dig himself a deeper grave, thought Bean. "I mean, you said that everybody scored as high as everybody else, and some scored higher, and that's just obviously not true." The man waited some more. "That's all I had to say." "Feel better," said the man. The boy sullenly kept his silence. Without disturbing his perfect smile, the man's tone changed, and instead of bright sarcasm, there was now a sharp whiff of menace. "I asked you a question, boy." "No, I don't feel better." "What's your name?" asked the man. "Nero." A couple of children who knew a little bit about history laughed at the name. Bean knew about the Emperor Nero. He did not laugh, however. He knew that a child named Bean was wise not to laugh at other kids' names. Besides, a name like that could be a real burden to bear. It said something about the boy's strength, or at least his defiance, that he didn't give some nickname. Or maybe Nero was his nickname. "Just Nero?" asked the man. "Nero Boulanger. French? Or just hungry?" Bean did not get the joke. Was Boulanger a name that had something to do with food? "Algerian." "Nero, you are an example to all the children on this shuttle. Because most of them are so foolish, they think it is better to keep their stupidest thoughts to themselves. You, however, understand the profound truth that you must reveal your stupidity openly. To hold your stupidity inside you is to embrace it, to cling to it, to protect it. But when you expose your stupidity, you give yourself the chance to have it caught, corrected, and replaced with wisdom. Be brave, all of you, like Nero Boulanger, and when you have a thought of such surpassing ignorance that you think it's actually smart, make sure to make some noise, to let your mental limitations squeak out some whimpering fart of a thought so that you have a chance to learn." Nero grumbled something. "Listen." Another flatulence, but this time even less articulate than before. "Tell us, Nero. Speak up. You are teaching us all by the example of your courage, however half-assed it might be." A couple of students laughed. "And listen, your fart has drawn out other farts from people equally stupid, for they think they are somehow superior to you, and that they could not just as easily have been chosen to be examples of superior intellect." There would be no more laughter. Bean felt a kind of dread, for he knew that somehow this verbal sparring, or rather this one-sided verbal assault, this torture, this public exposure, was going to find some twisted path that led to him. He did not know how he sensed this, for the uniformed man had not so much as glanced at Bean, and Bean had made no sound, had done nothing to call attention to himself. Yet he knew that he, not Nero, would end up receiving the cruelest thrust from this man's dagger. Then Bean realized why he was sure it would turn against him. This had turned into a nasty little argument about whether someone had higher test scores than anyone else on the shuttle. And Bean had assumed, for no reason whatsoever, that he was the child with the highest scores. Now that he had seen his own belief, he knew it was absurd. These children were all older and had grown up with far more advantages. He had had only Sister Carlotta as a teacher. Sister Carlotta and, of course, the street, though few of the things he learned there had shown up on the tests. There was no way that Bean had the highest score. Yet he still knew, with absolute certainty, that this discussion was full of danger for him. "I told you to speak up, Nero. I'm waiting." "I still don't see how anything I said was stupid," said Nero. "First, it was stupid because I have all the authority here, and you have none. So I have the power to make your life miserable, and you have no power to protect yourself. So how much intelligence does it take just to keep your mouth shut and avoid calling attention to yourself? What could be a more obvious decision to make when confronted with such a lopsided distribution of power?" Nero withered in his seat. "Second, you seemed to be listening to me, not to find out useful information, but to try to catch me in a logical fallacy. This tells us all that you are used to being smarter than your teachers, and that you listen to them in order to catch them making mistakes and prove how smart you are to the other students. This is such a pointless, stupid way of listening to teachers that it is clear you are going to waste months of our time before you finally catch on that the only transaction that matters is a transfer of useful information from adults who possess it to children who do not, and that catching mistakes is a criminal misuse of time." Bean silently disagreed. The criminal misuse of time was pointing out the mistakes, catching them, noticing them. That was essential. If you did not in your own mind distinguish between useful and erroneous information, then you were not learning at all. You were merely replacing ignorance with false belief, which was no improvement. The part of the man's statement that was true, however, was about the uselessness of speaking up. "If I know that the teacher is wrong and say nothing, then I remain the only one who knows, and that gives me an advantage over those who believe the teacher." "Third," said the man, "my statement only seems to be self-contradictory and impossible because you did not think beneath the surface of the situation. In fact, it is not necessarily true that one person has the highest scores of everyone on this shuttle. That's because there were many tests, physical, mental, social, and psychological, and many ways to define highest as well, since there are many ways to be physically or socially or psychologically fit for command. Children who tested highest on stamina may not have tested highest on strength. Children who tested highest on memory may not have tested highest on anticipatory analysis. Children with remarkable social skills might be weaker in delay of gratification. Are you beginning to grasp the shallowness of your thinking that led you to your stupid and useless conclusion?" Nero nodded. "Let us hear the sound of your flatulence again, Nero. Be just as loud in acknowledging your errors as you were in making them." "I was wrong." There was not a boy on that shuttle who would not have avowed a preference for death to being in Nero's place at that moment. And yet Bean felt a kind of envy as well, though he did not understand why he would envy the victim of such torture. "And yet," said the man, "you happen to be less wrong on this particular shuttle flight than you would have been in any other shuttle filled with launchies heading for battle school. And do you know why?" He did not choose to speak. "Does anyone know why? Can anyone guess? I am inviting speculation." No one accepted the invitation. "Then let me choose a volunteer. There is a child here named, improbable as it might sound, Bean. Would that child please speak?" "Here it comes," thought Bean. He was filled with dread, but he was also filled with excitement, because this was what he wanted, though he did not know why.
Look at me. Talk to me, you with the power, you with the authority.
I'm here, sir, said Bean.
The man made a show of looking and looking, unable to see where Bean was. Of course, it was a sham. He knew exactly where Bean was sitting before he ever spoke. I can't see where your voice came from. Would you raise a hand?
Bean immediately raised his hand. He realized, to his shame, that his hand did not even reach to the top of the high-backed seat.
I still can't see you, said the man, though of course he could. I give you permission to unstrap and stand on your seat.
Bean immediately complied, peeling off the harness and bounding to his feet. He was barely taller than the back of the seat in front of him.
Ah, there you are, said the man. Bean, would you be so kind as to speculate about why, in this shuttle, Nero comes closer to being correct than on any other?
Maybe somebody here scored highest on a lot of tests.
Not just a lot of tests, Bean. All the tests of intellect, all the psychological tests, all the tests pertinent to command. Every one of them. Higher than anyone else on this shuttle.
So I was right, said the newly defiant Nero.
No, you were not, said the man. Because that remarkable child, the one who scored highest on all the tests related to command, happens to have scored the very lowest on the physical tests. And do you know why?
No one answered.
Bean, as long as you're standing, can you speculate about why this one child might have scored lowest on the physical tests?
Bean knew how he had been set up, and he refused to try to hide from the obvious answer. He would say it, even though the question was designed to make the others detest him for answering it. After all, they would detest him anyway, no matter who said the answer.
Maybe he scored lowest on the physical tests because he's very, very small. Groans from many boys showed their disgust at his answer, at the arrogance and vanity that it suggested. But the man in uniform only nodded gravely.
As should be expected from a boy of such remarkable ability, you are exactly correct.
Only this boy's unusually small stature prevented Nero from being correct about there being one child with higher scores than everybody else.
He turned to Nero.
So close to not being a complete fool, he said. And yet, even if you had been right, it would only have been by accident. A broken clock is right 2 times a day. Sit down now, Bean, and put on your harness. The refueling is over and we're about to boost. Bean sat down. He could feel the hostility of the other children. There was nothing he could do about that right now, and he wasn't sure that it was a disadvantage anyway. What mattered was the much more puzzling question, why did the man set him up like that? If the point was to get the kids competing with each other, they could have passed around a list with everyone's scores on all the tests so they all could see where they stood. Instead, Bean had been singled out. He was already the smallest and knew from experience that he was, therefore, a target for every mean-spirited impulse in a bully's heart. So why did they draw this big circle around him and all these arrows pointing at him, practically demanding that he be the main target of everyone's fear and hate?
Draw your targets. Aim your darts. I'm going to do well enough in this school that someday I'll be the one with the authority, and then it won't matter who likes me. What will matter is who I like.
As you may remember, said the man, before the first fart from the mouthhole of Nero Baker Boy here, I was starting to make a point. I was telling you that even though some child here may seem like a prime target for your pathetic need to assert supremacy in a situation where you are unsure of being recognized for the hero that you want people to think you are, you must control yourself and refrain from poking or pinching, jabbing or hitting, or even making snidely provocative remarks or sniggering like warthogs just because you think somebody is an easy target.
And the reason why you should refrain from doing this is because you don't know who in this group is going to end up being your commander in the future, the admiral when you're a mere captain. And if you think for one moment that they will forget how you treated them now, today, then you really are a fool. If they're good commanders, they'll use you effectively in combat no matter how they despise you. But they don't have to be helpful to you in advancing your career. They don't have to nurture you and bring you along. They don't have to be kind and forgiving. Just think about that. The people you see around you will someday be giving you orders that will decide whether you live or die. I'd suggest you work on earning their respect, not trying to put them down so you can show off like some schoolyard punk. The man turned his icy smile on Bean one more time. And I'll bet that Bean here is already planning to be the admiral who gives you all orders someday. He's even planning how he'll order me to stand solitary watch on some asteroid observatory till my bones melt from osteoporosis and I ooze around the station like an amoeba. Bean hadn't given a moment's thought to some future contest between him and this particular officer. He had no desire for vengeance. He wasn't a shield. Ashiel was stupid, and this officer was stupid for thinking that Bean would think that way. No doubt, however, the man thought Bean would be grateful because he had just warned the others not to pick on him. But Bean had been picked on by tougher bastards than these could possibly be. This officer's protection was not needed, and it made the gulf between Bean and the other children wider than before. If Bean could have lost a couple of tussles, he would have been humanized, accepted, perhaps. But now there would be no tussles. No easy way to build bridges. That was the reason for the annoyance that the man apparently saw on Bean's face. I've got a word for you, Bean. I don't care what you do to me. Because there's only one enemy that matters. The buggers. And if you can grow up to be the admiral who can give us victory over the buggers and keep Earth safe for humanity, then make me eat my own guts, ass first, and I'll still say thank you, sir. The buggers are the enemy. Not Nero. Not Bean. Not even me. So keep your hands off each other. He grinned again, mirthlessly. Besides, the last time somebody tried picking on another kid, he ended up flying through the shuttle in Null G and got his arm broken. It's one of the laws of strategy. Until you know that you're tougher than the enemy, you maneuver. You don't commit to battle. Consider that your first lesson in battle school. First lesson? No wonder they used this guy to tend children on the shuttle flights instead of having him teach. If you followed that little piece of wisdom, you'd be paralyzed against a vigorous enemy. Sometimes you have to commit to a fight even when you're weak. You don't wait till you know you're tougher. You make yourself tougher by whatever means you can, and then you strike by surprise. You sneak up, you backstab, you blindside, you cheat, you lie, you do whatever it takes to make sure that you come out on top. This guy might be real tough as the only adult on a shuttle full of kids, but if he were a kid on the streets of Rotterdam, he'd maneuver himself into starvation in a month. If he wasn't killed before that just for talking like he thought his piss was perfume. The man turned to head back to the control cabin. Bean called out to him. "What's your name?" The man turned and fixed him with a withering stare. "Already drafting the orders to have my balls ground to powder, Bean?" Bean didn't answer, just looked him in the eye. "I'm Captain Dymack. Anything else you want to know?" "Might as well find out now as later." "Do you teach at battle school?" "Yes," he said. "Coming down to pick up shuttle loads of little boys and girls is how we get Earthside leave. Just as with you, my being on this shuttle means my vacation is over." The refueling planes peeled away and rose above them. No, it was their own craft that was sinking, and the tail was sinking lower than the nose of the shuttle. Metal covers came down over the windows. It felt like they were falling faster, faster, until with a bone-shaking roar the rockets fired and the shuttle began to rise again, higher, faster, faster, until Bean felt like he was going to be pushed right through the back of his chair. It seemed to go on forever, unchanging. Then, silence. Silence, and then a wave of panic. They were falling again, but this time there was no downward direction, just nausea and fear. Bean closed his eyes. It didn't help. He opened them again, tried to reorient himself. No direction provided equilibrium. But he had schooled himself on the street not to succumb to nausea. A lot of the food he had to eat had already gone a little bad, and he couldn't afford to throw it up. So he went into his anti-nausea routine. Deep breaths, distracting himself by concentrating on wiggling his toes. And after a surprisingly short time, he was used to the nausea. As long as he didn't expect any direction to be down, he was fine. The other kids didn't have his routine, or perhaps they were more susceptible to the sudden, relentless loss of balance. Now the reason for the prohibition against eating before the launch became clear. There was plenty of retching going on, but with nothing to throw up, there was no mess, no smell. Dymac came back into the shuttle cabin, this time standing on the ceiling. Very cute, thought Bean. Another lecture began, this time about how to get rid of planet-side assumptions about directions and gravity. Could these kids possibly be so stupid they needed to be told such obvious stuff? Bean occupied the time of the lecture by seeing how much pressure it took to move himself around within his loosely fitting harness. Everybody else was big enough that the harnesses fit snugly and prevented movement. Bean alone had room for a little maneuvering. He made the most of it. By the time they arrived at battle school, he was determined to have at least a little skill at movement in Null G. He figured that in space, his survival might someday depend on knowing just how much force it would take to move his body, and then how much force it would take to stop. Knowing it in his mind wasn't half so important as knowing it with his body. Analyzing things was fine, but good reflexes could save your life.
Chapter 6. Ender's Shadow.
Normally, your reports on a launch group are brief, a few troublemakers, an incident report, or, best of all, nothing.
You're free to disregard any portion of my report, sir.
Sir? My, but aren't we the prickly martinet today?
What part of my report did you think was excessive?
I think this report is a love song.
I realize that it might seem like sucking up to use with every launch the technique you used with Ender Wiggin.
You use it with every launch?
As you noticed yourself, sir, it has interesting results. It causes an immediate sorting out.
A sorting out into categories that might not otherwise exist. Nevertheless, I accept the compliment implied by your action. But 7 pages about Bean? Really? Did you actually learn that much from a response that was primarily silent compliance?
That is just my point, sir. It was not compliance at all. I was performing the experiment, but it felt as though his were the big eye looking down the microscope, and I were the specimen on the slide.
So he unnerved you?
He would unnerve anyone. He's cold, sir. And yet
hot. Yes, I read your report. Every scintillating page of it.
Yes, sir.
I think you know that it is considered good advice for us not to get crushes on our students.
Sir?
In this case, however, I am delighted that you are so interested in Bean. Because, you see, I am not. I already have the boy I think gives us our best chance. Yet there is considerable pressure because of Bean's damnable faked-up test scores to give him special attention. Very well. He shall have it, and you shall give it to him.
But, sir...
Perhaps you are unable to distinguish an order from an invitation.
I'm only concerned that I think he already has a low opinion of me.
Good. Then he'll underestimate you. Unless you think his low opinion might be correct.
Compared to him, sir, we might all be a little dim.
Close attention is your assignment. Try not to worship him.
All that Bean had on his mind was survival that first day in battle school. No one would help him. That had been made clear by Dymac's little charade in the shuttle. They were setting him up to be surrounded by... what? Rivals at best, enemies at worst. So it was the street again. Well, that was fine. Bean had survived on the street, and would have kept on surviving, even if Sister Carlotta hadn't found him. Even Pablo. Bean might have made it even without Pablo the janitor finding him in the toilet of the clean place. So he watched. He listened. Everything the others learned, he had to learn just as well, maybe better. And on top of that, he had to learn what the others were oblivious to. The workings of the group, the systems of the battle school. How teachers got on with each other, where the power was, who was afraid of whom. Every group had its bosses, its suck-ups, its rebels, its sheep. Every group had its strong bonds and its weak ones, friendships and hypocrisies. Lies within lies within lies. And Bean had to find them all as quickly as possible in order to learn the spaces in which he could survive. They were taken to their barracks, given beds, lockers, little portable desks that were much more sophisticated than the one he had used when studying with Sister Carlotta. Some of the kids immediately began to play with them, trying to program them or exploring the games built into them, but Bean had no interest in that. The computer system of Battle School was not a person. Mastering it might be helpful in the long run, but for today it was irrelevant. What Bean needed to find out was all outside the launchy barracks. Which is where, soon enough, they went. They arrived in the morning, according to space time, which, to the annoyance of many in Europe and Asia, meant Florida time, since the earliest stations had been controlled from there. For the kids, having launched from Europe, it was late afternoon, and that meant they would have a serious time lag problem. Dymac explained that the cure for this was to get vigorous physical exercise and then take a short nap. No more than 3 hours in the early afternoon, following which they would again have plenty of physical exercise so they could fall asleep that night at the regular bedtime for students. They piled out to form a line in the corridor. Green, brown, green, said Dymac, and showed them how those lines on the corridor walls would always lead them back to their barracks. Bean found himself jostled out of line several times and ended up right at the back. He didn't care. Mere jostling drew no blood and left no bruise, and last in line was the best place from which to observe. Other kids passed them in the corridor, sometimes individuals, sometimes pairs or trios, most with brightly colored uniforms in many different designs. Once they passed an entire group dressed alike and wearing helmets and carrying extravagant sidearms, jogging along with an intensity of purpose that Bean found intriguing. They're a crew, he thought, and they're heading off for a fight. They weren't too intense to notice the new kids walking along the corridor, looking up at them in awe. Immediately there were catcalls. Launchies! Fresh meat! Who make cocoa in the hall and don't clean it up? They even smell stupid. But it was all harmless banter, older kids asserting their supremacy. It meant nothing more than that. No real hostility. In fact, it was almost affectionate. They remembered being launchies themselves. Some of the launchies ahead of Bean in line were resentful and called back some vague, pathetic insults, which only caused more hooting and derision from the older kids. Bean had seen older, bigger kids who hated younger ones because they were competition for food and drove them away, not caring if they caused the little ones to die. He had felt real blows, meant to hurt. He had seen cruelty, exploitation, molestation, murder. These other kids didn't know love when they saw it. What Bean wanted to know was how that crew was organized, who led it, how he was chosen, what the crew was for. The fact that they had their own uniform meant that it had official status. So that meant that the adults were ultimately in control. The opposite of the way crews were organized in Rotterdam, where adults tried to break them up, where newspapers wrote about them as criminal conspiracies instead of pathetic little leagues for survival. That really was the key.
Everything the children did here was shaped by adults. In Rotterdam, the adults were either hostile, unconcerned, or, like Helga with her charity kitchen, ultimately powerless. So the children could shape their own society without interference. Everything was based on survival, on getting enough food without getting killed or injured or sick. Here there were cooks and doctors, clothing and beds. Power wasn't about access to food. It was about getting the approval of adults. That's what those uniforms meant. Adults chose them, and children wore them because adults somehow made it worth their while. So the key to everything was understanding the teachers. All this passed through Bean's mind, not so much verbally as with a clear and almost instantaneous understanding that within that crew there was no power at all, compared to the power of the teachers, before the uniformed catcallers reached him. When they saw Bean, so much smaller than any of the other kids, they broke out laughing, hooting, howling. "That one isn't big enough to be a turd. I can't believe he can walk. Diddums woozums, mama. Is it even human?" Bean tuned them out immediately, but he could feel the enjoyment of the kids ahead of him in line. They had been humiliated in the shuttle. Now it was Bean's turn to be mocked. They loved it. And so did Bean, because it meant that he was seen as less of a rival. By diminishing him, the passing soldiers had made him just that much safer from... From what? What was the danger here? For there would be danger. That he knew. There was always danger. And since the teachers had all the power, the danger would come from them. But Dymac had started things out by turning the other kids against him. So the children themselves were the weapons of choice. Bean had to get to know the other kids, not because they themselves were going to be his problem, but because their weaknesses, their desires, could be used against him by the teachers. And to protect himself, Bean would have to work to undercut their hold on the other children. The only safety here was to subvert the teacher's influence. And yet that was the greatest danger, if he was caught doing it. They palmed in on a wall-mounted pad, then slid down a pole. The first time Bean had ever done it with a smooth shaft. In Rotterdam, all his sliding had been on rain spouts, signposts, and light poles. They ended up in a section of battle school with higher gravity. Bean did not realize how light they must have been on the barracks level until he felt how heavy he was down in the gym. "This is just a little heavier than Earth normal gravity," said Dymac. "You have to spend at least a half hour a day here, or your bones start to dissolve. And you have to spend the time exercising so you keep at peak endurance. And that's the key. Endurance exercise, not bulking up. You're too small for your bodies to endure that kind of training, and it fights you here. Stamina. That's what we want." The words meant almost nothing to the kids, but soon the trainer had made it clear. Lots of running on treadmills, riding on cycles, stair-stepping, push-ups, sit-ups, chin-ups, back-ups, but no weights. Some weight equipment was there, but it was all for the use of teachers. "Your heart rate is monitored from the moment you enter here," said the trainer. "If you don't have your heart rate elevated within 5 minutes of arrival and you don't keep it elevated for the next 25 minutes, it goes on your record and I see it on my control board here." "I get a report on it too," said Dymac. "And you go on the pig list for everyone to see you've been lazy." Pig list. So that's the tool they used, shaming them in front of the others. Stupid. As if Bean cared. It was the monitoring board that Bean was interested in. How could they possibly monitor their heart rates and know what they were doing automatically from the moment they arrived? He almost asked the question until he realized the only possible answer. The uniform. It was in the clothing. Some system of sensors. It probably told them a lot more than heart rate. For one thing, they could certainly track every kid wherever he was in the station all the time. There must be hundreds and hundreds of kids here, and there would be computers reporting the whereabouts, the heart rates, and who could guess what other information about them. Was there a room somewhere with teachers watching every step they took? Or maybe it wasn't the clothes. After all, they had to palm in before coming down here, presumably to identify themselves. So maybe there were special sensors in this room. Time to find out. Bean raised his hand. Sir, he said. Yes? The trainer did a double take on seeing Bean's size, and a smile played around the corners of his mouth. He glanced at Dymac. Dymac did not crack a smile or show any understanding of what the trainer was thinking. Is the heart rate monitor in our clothing? If we take off any part of our clothes while we're exercising, does it... You are not authorized to be out of uniform in the gym, said the trainer. The room is kept cold on purpose so that you will not need to remove clothing. You will be monitored at all times. Not really an answer, but it told him what he needed to know. The monitoring depended on the clothes. Maybe there was an identifier in the clothing, and by palming in, they told the gym sensors which kid was wearing which set of clothing. That would make sense. So clothing was probably anonymous from the time you put on a clean set until you palmed in somewhere. That was important. It meant that it might be possible to be untagged without being naked. Naked, Bean figured, would probably be conspicuous around here. They all exercised, and the trainer told them which of them were not up to the right heart rate, and which of them were pushing too hard and would fatigue themselves too soon. Bean quickly got an idea of the level he had to work at, and then forgot about it. He'd remember by reflex, now that he knew. It was mealtime, then. They were alone in the mess hall. As fresh arrivals, they were on a separate schedule that day. The food was good, and there was a lot of it. Bean was stunned when some of the kids looked at their portion and complained about how little there was. It was a feast. Bean couldn't finish it. The whiners were informed by the cooks that the quantities were all adapted to their individual dietary needs. Each kid's portion size came up on a computer display when he palmed in upon entering the mess hall. So you don't eat without your palm on a pad. Important to know. Bean soon found out that his size was going to get official attention. When he brought his half-finished tray to the disposal unit, an electronic chiming sound brought the on-duty nutritionist to speak to him. It's your first day, so we aren't going to be rigid about it. But your portions are scientifically calibrated to meet your dietary needs, and in the future, you will finish every bit of what you are served. Bean looked at him without a word. He had already made his decision. If his exercise program made him hungrier, then he'd eat more. But if they were expecting him to gorge himself, they could forget it. It would be a simple enough matter to dump excess food onto the trays of the whiners. They'd be happy with it, and Bean would eat only as much as his body wanted. He remembered hunger very well, but he had lived with Sister Carlotta for many months, and he knew to trust his own appetite. For a while, he had let her goad him into eating more than he actually was hungry for. The result had been a sense of loginess, a harder time sleeping, and a harder time staying awake. He went back to eating only as much as his body wanted, letting his hunger be his guide, and it kept him sharp and quick. That was the only nutritionist he trusted. Let the whiners get sluggish. Dymac stood after several of them had finished eating. When you're through, go back to the barracks. If you think you can find it. If you have any doubt, wait for me and I'll bring the last group back myself. The corridors were empty when Bean went out into the corridor. The other kids palmed the wall and their green-brown-green strip turned on. Bean watched them go. One of them turned back. Aren't you coming? Bean said nothing. There was nothing to say. He was obviously standing still. It was a stupid question. The kid turned around and jogged on down the corridor toward the barracks. Bean went the other way. No stripes on the wall. He knew that there was no better time to explore than now. If he was caught out of the area he was supposed to be in, they'd believe him if he claimed to have got lost. The corridor sloped up both behind him and in front of him. To his eyes, it looked like he was always going uphill, and when he looked back, it was uphill to go back the way he had come. Strange. But Dymac had already explained that the station was a huge wheel, spinning in space so that centrifugal force would replace gravity. That meant the main corridor on each level was a big circle, so you'd always come back to where you started, and down was always toward the outside of the circle. Bean made the mental adjustment. It was dizzying at first, to picture himself on his side as he walked along, but then he mentally changed the orientation so that he imagined the station as a wheel on a cart, with him at the bottom of it no matter how much it turned. That put the people above him upside down, but he didn't care. Wherever he was the bottom, and that way down stayed down and up stayed up. The launchies were on the mess hall level, but the older kids must not be, because after the mess halls and the kitchens, there were only classrooms and unmarked doors with palm pads high enough that they were clearly not meant for children to enter. Other kids could probably reach those pads, but not even by jumping could Bean hope to palm one. It didn't matter. They wouldn't respond to any child's handprint except to bring some adult to find out what the kid thought he was doing, trying to enter a room where he had no business. By long habit, or was it instinct, Bean regarded such barriers as only temporary blocks. He knew how to climb over walls in Rotterdam, how to get up on roofs. Short as he was, he still found ways to get wherever he needed to go. Those doors would not stop him if he decided he needed to get beyond them. He had no idea right now how he'd do it, but he had no doubt that he would find a way. So he wasn't annoyed. He simply tucked the information away, waiting until he thought of some way to use it. Every few meters there was a pole for downward passage or a ladderway for going up. To get down the pole to the gym, he had had to palm a pad. But there seemed to be no pad on most of these. Which made sense. Most poles and ladderways would merely let you pass between floors. No, they called them decks. This was the international fleet, and so everything pretended to be a ship. While only one pole led down to the gym, to which they needed to control access so that it didn't get overcrowded with people coming when they weren't scheduled. As soon as he had made sense of it, Bean didn't have to think of it anymore. He scrambled up a ladder. The next floor up had to be the barracks level for the older kids. Doors were more widely spaced, and each door had an insignia on it. Using the colors of some uniform, no doubt based on their stripe colors, though he doubted the older kids ever had to palm the wall to find their way around, there was also the silhouette of an animal. Some of them he didn't recognize, but he recognized a couple of birds, some cats, a dog, a lion, whatever was in use symbolically on signs in Rotterdam. No pigeon, no fly. Only noble animals, or animals noted for courage. The dog silhouette looked like some kind of hunting animal, very thin around the hips. Not a mongrel. So this is where the crews meet. And they have animal symbols, which means they probably call themselves by animal names. Cat crew. Or maybe lion crew. And probably not crew. Bean would soon learn what they called themselves. He closed his eyes and tried to remember the colors and insignia on the crew that passed and mocked him in the corridor earlier. He could see the shape in his mind, but didn't see it on any of the doors he passed. It didn't matter. Not worth traveling the whole corridor in search of it when that would only increase his risk of getting caught. Up again. More barracks, more classrooms. How many kids in a barracks? This place was bigger than he thought. A soft chime sounded. Immediately, several doors opened and kids began to pour out into the corridor. A changeover time. At first, Bean felt more secure among the big kids because he thought he could get lost in the crowd, the way he always did in Rotterdam. But that habit was useless here. This wasn't a random crowd of people on their own errands. These might be kids, but they were military. They knew where everybody was supposed to be, and Bean, in his launchy uniform, was way out of place. Almost at once, a couple of older kids stopped him.
You don't belong on this deck, said one. At once, several others stopped to look at Bean as if he were an object washed into the street by a storm. Look at the size of this one. Poor kid gots to sniff everybody's butt, eh?
Hey, you're out of area, Launchy.
Bean said nothing, just looked at each one as he spoke. Or she.
What are your colors?
Asked a girl. Bean said nothing. Best excuse would be that he didn't remember, so he couldn't very well name them now.
He's so small he could walk between my legs without touching my...
Oh, shut up, Dink. That's what you said when Ender...
Yeah, Ender.
Right. You don't think this is the kid that... Was Ender this small when he arrived?
Been saying he another Ender?
Right. Like this one's gonna shoot to the top of the standings.
It wasn't Ender's fault that Bonzo wouldn't let him fire his weapon.
But it's a fluke, that's all I'm saying.
This is the one they're talking about? One like Ender? Top scores?
Just get him down to the Launchy level. Come with me, said the girl, taking him firmly by the hand. Bean came along meekly.
My name is Petra Arcanian, she said.
Bean said nothing.
Come on. You may be little and you may be scared, but they don't let you in here if you're deaf or stupid.
Bean shrugged.
Tell me your name before I break your stubby little fingers.
Bean, he said.
That's not a name. That's a lousy meal.
He said nothing.
You don't fool me, she said. This mute thing, it's just a cover. You came up here on purpose.
He kept his silence, but it stabbed at him that she had figured him out so easily.
Kids for this school, they're chosen because they're smart and they've got initiative.
So of course you wanted to explore.
The thing is, they expect it. They probably know you're doing it. So there's no point in hiding it.
What are they going to do, give you some big bad piggy points? So that's what the older kids thought about the pig list. This stubborn silence thing, it'll just piss people off. I'd forget about it if I were you. Maybe it worked with Mommy and Daddy, but it just makes you look stubborn and ridiculous because anything that matters, you're going to tell anyway, so why not just talk?
Okay, said Bean.
Now that he was complying, she didn't crow about it. The lecture worked, so the lecture was over.
Colors? She asked.
Green, brown, green.
Those Launchy colors sound like something you'd find in a dirty toilet, don't you think?
So she was just another one of the stupid kids who thought it was cute to make fun of Launchies.
It's like they designed everything to get the older kids to make fun of the younger ones.
Or maybe she wasn't. Maybe she was just talking. She was a talker. There weren't a lot of talkers on the streets. Not among the kids, anyway. Plenty of them among the drunks.
The system around here is screwed. It's like they want us to act like little kids.
Not that that's going to bother you. Hell, you're already doing some dumb, lost little kid act.
Not now, he said. Just remember this. No matter what you do, the teachers know about it, and they already have some stupid theory about what this means about your personality or whatever. They always find a way to use it against you, if they want to, so you might as well not try. No doubt it's already in your report that you took this little jaunt when you were supposed to be having Betty by time, and that probably tells them that you respond to insecurity by seeking to be alone while exploring the limits of your new environment. She used a fancy voice for the last part. And maybe she had more voices to show off to him, but he wasn't going to stick around to find out. Apparently she was a take-charge person and didn't have anybody to take charge of until he came along. He wasn't interested in becoming her project. It was all right being Sister Carlotta's project because she could get him out of the street and into battle school. But what did this Petra Arcanian have to offer him? He slid down a pole, stopped in front of the first opening, pushed out into the corridor, ran to the next ladderway, and scooted up two decks before emerging into another corridor and running full out. She was probably right in what she said, but one thing was certain. He was not going to have her hold his hand all the way back to green, brown, green. The last thing he needed, if he was going to hold his own in this place, was to show up with some older kid holding his hand. Bean was four decks above the mess level where he was supposed to be right now.
There were kids moving through here, but nowhere near as many as the deck below. Most of the doors were unmarked, but a few stood open, including one wide arch that opened into a game room. Bean had seen computer games in some of the bars in Rotterdam, but only from a distance, through the doors and between the legs of men and women going in and out in their endless search for oblivion. He had never seen a child playing a computer game except on the vids in store windows. Here it was real, with only a few players catching quick games between classes so that each game's sounds stood out. A few kids playing solo games, and then four of them playing a four-sided space game with a holographic display. Bean stood back far enough not to intrude in their sight lines and watched them play. Each of them controlled a squadron of four tiny ships, with the goal of either wiping out all the other fleets or capturing, but not destroying, each player's slow-moving mothership. He learned the rules and the terminology by listening to the four boys' chatter as they played.